This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor, and Professor Richard Epstein of the Hoover Institution, teaches law at NYU and the University of Chicago, is here doing me the great favor of traveling in time from Londinium 90 AD, where Rome was all-powerful, but who's going to fix the bridge? The Thames flooded again, to 2021, where the United States of America, for argument's sake, is all-powerful. And we now debate infrastructure. What Julius Caesar would do if asked to make up the difference in shortfall for public education is that he would borrow a great deal of money, never actually thinking he had to repay it. He would hold games, everybody would celebrate him, and then the schools would fix themselves. That was Caesar's approach. Well, we don't use that anymore, I think. Professor, you make the very wonderful argument that the word infrastructure is itself a bridge between classical liberal thinking about the responsibilities of the state and private enterprise and the progressives. How does it connect these two, and is it good that it connects them?
Well, actually, it's extremely dangerous. One of the things that you discover is that the progressive movement has always tried to capitalize on the vocabulary that was first developed by classical liberals. So, for example, the classical liberal believes that physical security against force and fraud is one of the major tasks that the state has to defend and is willing to fund the public police force in order to do that. And so we start talking about security as being the highest good. Well, in 1935, what you did is you passed the Social Security Act. But this was not an act which was designed to protect you against aggression and to allow you to develop your own finances. This was a system of forced taxation from some individuals in order to make sure that other individuals had the appropriate level. And if you start talking about it in that particular fashion, now all of a sudden security becomes a huge club for redistribution rather than a club for making sure that people can have sufficient space in which to do their kinds of voluntary contracts. And if you want to take another New Deal illustration, they start talking about free collective bargaining. Well, it's not free collective bargaining. They're not protecting autonomy. What they're doing is they're saying that workers can band together under some kind of voting machine and basically exclude all other competitors and divide the lolly amongst them in a monopolization case. And that's called a form of freedom on these situations, or a realization of autonomy. It's a realization of autonomy for the people who are favored, but it's a massive contraction of autonomy for everybody else. Infrastructure is another one of those words. If you tried to say, well, anything for which a long-term benefit could come from a current investment is infrastructure, that means, in effect, what you can do is take over the entire system of education and say that, you know, since this is very important, we're going to fund it for everybody. And it turns out, however, that there's a real flaw to this. You take the Bernie Sanders proposal, for example, that everybody gets free community college and so forth. If you're spending somebody else's money, you're not going to spend it wisely. You're not going to correctly do the kind of work that's needed. If you have to borrow money from your parents or from your friends, you're going to have to perform, or otherwise it's going to be lost. If you borrow it from the state, there'll just be a massive set of defaults, which is what has happened with the student loan programs all in place. And so the thought that somehow or other, because something is a long-term investment, that you need to have federal or state funding for it is very difficult. And in fact, the wedge in this thing is, what do we do with a education K through 12? There's a large sentiment out there for saying that everybody should have these kinds of supports. And then the state takes over running the entire system. And what happens is it becomes a funnel. You get huge amounts of money from taxation, then you transfer it to unions who earn monopoly wages and short-term everybody else in sort of the middle. And so the Milton Friedman situation, which was a very clever idea if you could only implement it, was, we will basically make sure that the state will handle the funding obligation, but then we'll use market mechanisms which will allow the parents to spend that money on the education of their own choice. And that competition will, for example, put unions in a very, very bad disadvantage. And it will also encourage people, when it comes to putting their packages together, to try to find parts of the market which are not served particularly well, so that instead of having a single mass curriculum like you do in California, which essentially serves nobody's interest, you start getting competition on multiple dimensions, the kinds of hours you work, the kinds of instructions you work, the kinds of curriculum that you have, and so forth. So calling all of these long-term investments as infrastructure is just an excuse for trying to run the socialization. The classical liberal says, okay, if you think there are certain kinds of deficits that you have to cure because of poverty and similar situations, you want to do two things. First, you want to reduce the barrier so as to reduce the particular costs in question. And then, to the extent that people do provide their own stuff, you don't want to tax them so they have to pay for everybody else. And if, in fact, there has to be a public subsidy, what you try to do is to make sure that it goes to its intended recipients and is not going to be captured by the people who provide the services, which is the way public service unions work today. And so this system is extremely complicated. The classical liberal is always trying to find a way to minimize the level of government intervention if it turns out there's some kind of a market shortfall. The progressive is always doing the opposite, trying to put aside the private solutions so they can dominate. Let me give you one more example. Company unions are always a terrific issue to talk about. Before the rise of the National Labor Relations Act, companies used to form unions of their own workers voluntarily. Why did they do this? Because they realized that they could talk to unions through an organized body, they could get good information from them on how to improve the process and improve relationships by essentially creating a kind of parity and equity amongst the workers. Well, if in fact you have company unions, trade unions from the outside are going to have a real competitor. So what did they do? They decided to call these things stooges, and then they banned them under the National Labor Relations Act so as to basically maximize hostile unions over friendly unions. It's a classic illustration of where it is that you kind of see a quote-unquote market failure. That market failure, so-called, is now solved by a private solution. And what you do is you come in and you squash the private solution so you could put another public solution in place. And that is essentially the progressive playbook for DeRay, and it's why it's so dangerous, because the moment you start saying there's a long-term investment, there's a dominant role for government, it turns out that virtually every single form of capital inquiry is going to go that way. Investments in education are going to go that way. Building are going to go that way. Infrastructure and innovation are going to go that way. And by the time you're done, you will have people like Bernie Sanders, who knows literally nothing about how any of these institutions work, are trying to call the shots as being the head of the budget committee.
You make me smile, Richard, because what you've described of the progressive system is would be very comfortably recognizable to Rome. The idea that you control not only the levers of government, but who is to be rewarded for doing the work of the levers of government. A final minute thought. We just have a minute now. Telemedicine. Yes. How would that benefit from today's understanding of infrastructure?
Well, what happens is you don't need it as infrastructure. What you do is you could find ways to give treatment remotely. And what you want to do is to make sure that states don't have licensing requirements that make it impossible for people who are sitting in Massachusetts to take care of people in Vermont. The rule has to be an open system that if you're licensed to take care of people in your own state, you're licensed by telemedicine to take care of anybody anywhere throughout the world. You then introduce competition. The moment you introduce competition, prices drop, and then you eliminate the need for government subsidies for the kinds of things that you have under the Obamacare program. So competitive solutions have the following key advantages. There are two of them. One is they're always cheaper in terms of administrative costs, and B, they're much more responsive to the needs of consumers.
So the classical liberal approach to telemedicine today would free the burden of state boundaries in the United States, just here. Is that correct?
That's correct. Essentially, state licensing laws are understood to be barriers to entry.
Professor Richard Epstein, writing most recently at Defining Ideas about the word infrastructure, the word itself, doing me the great favor of traveling 2,000 years from Roman Britain to Washington, D.C., observing how we've moved the case only a little bit. We've introduced markets, but the same power of the state applies. The Roman Empire, the American Empire, this is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor.
You're listening to CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor.